Modern Web with Brian Lagunas.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host for helping you and your teams move fast, deliver quality, and to run your software with confidence in Azure, all while using everything that the .NET ecosystem has to offer. The podcast is sponsored by ClearMeasure, a software architecture company that empowers .NET teams to be self-sufficient and able to deliver world-class results through its ClearMeasure Way methodology. And this is probably the last podcast with this announcement just because of the dates, but this month, January 2023, where it's been recording, I'm hosting some architect forums. And if you're an architect or any other software team leader, then perhaps you don't have a peer in your organization to discuss, you know, unique issues that you face. So in the architect forums, you'll be able to discuss those real questions and topics with other software architects about leading a software engineering team that wants to establish quality and achieve stability and move really, really fast. So it's your opportunity to hear what others have to say. And I will be facilitating those forums, and we'll keep the participation low in each time slot so that we can have meaningful conversations. We already have two scheduled and they're filling up. So register at the link in the show notes or on the ClearMeasure website for the January forums before they fill up. And for those of you looking for the Programming with Palermo video podcast, just go ahead and search in any of the podcast directories or on YouTube and you'll be able to find it. Now, my guest today on the show is Brian Lagunas, and he is a Microsoft MVP, a Microsoft Patterns and Practices champion, leader of the Boise.NET Developers User Group, a board member of Boise Code Camp, speaker, trainer, Pluralsight author, and he can be found speaking at a variety of developer events around the world. His talks always involve some form of markup, XAML or HTML, as well as how to build well-architected applications with Prism. And in his spare time, he authors courses for Pluralsight, blogs, and live streams about various technologies and manages the Prism library. And the easiest way to find Brian is on his Twitter at Brian Lagunas, B-R-I-A-N-L-A-G-U-N-A-S. Brian, welcome to the show. How are you, sir?
I am wonderful. Thank you for the invite and having me today.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. You've done so much, but kind of backing up before all this, as I understand it, you've also been in law enforcement and in the Army, even besides programming, haven't you?
Oh, I've done a lot. Yeah, I was in the Army, came out. The only thing I could do was be a cop. That job sucked. I was even an editor for a news station. Yeah, nice. So you know, when you watch the news and the news anchor sitting there talking, and you see the video pop up, yep, and it goes to the next video. Yeah, I edited and played all those videos on cue.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, you know, there's Greg Leonardo was another guest who was in the Army. And so there's a little group of Microsoft MVPs who kind of have past military experience. It's fun to talk about. So, well, I want to get into the techie fun stuff, but what was it that kind of triggered your mind and say, you know what, I'm going to get into programming?
My body, for one. You know, I was light infantry in the Army, so I was a ground soldier.
That's a rough job. Know,
packing around 120-pound rucksacks. Plus, I was a gunner on the team. So I had a big M240 Bravo, which is a huge 50-pound machine gun. I have a separate guy that carries my tripod for me and some ammo, but it was a big load on my knees and my back. And, you know, I got out, tried to do the cop thing. And my body just wasn't having that anymore. And so I'm like, man, I need to do something else. So interestingly enough, I actually started with game development. Mm-hmm. I actually went to school and got a degree in game design.
Nice.
But during that degree is when I discovered programming. And then I got another degree after that. I changed my mind.
There you go. Changing your mind's good. I changed my mind. I started as computer engineering, and then I realized that I didn't like silicone. And I'm like, no, I like the programming side. I don't like this hardware side.
Yeah, well, it was cool because I was still able to create, but it's just I was just creating different things. Yeah. You know, instead of games, I was creating applications and experiences.
That's cool. What were the high points that kind of have led you into what you're working on today?
Dude, I've been doing this for so long. I don't even know if I can remember. 20 years at least I've been doing this.
Mm-hmm. And you've been in Infogistics for a while.
Yeah, this is my 11th year, actually.
Mm-hmm.
2023 is February, actually, is 11 years
for yeah. me. Now, I always have to remember that probably more than half the listeners got into the industry in the last 7 years. You know, if we believe the statistics that over the last 7 years and the 7 years prior to that, the number of developers has doubled each of those 7 year blocks, then, you know, people like you and me who were working on .NET 1.0 and any technologies before that are in the minority. And so you've been working on .NET. It's been around for most of your programming career, right?
Yeah, I started in Java because that's how new .NET was.
Mm-hmm.
I actually started in Java and Notepad with the Spring framework and all that, and then moved to .NET. First, it was VB. I'm not sure C# was around just yet. And then I switched to C# once mm-hmm. I became familiar with that.
So for those who kind of don't have that perspective, what is it about .NET that has caused you to still be wanting to work with that technology after all these years and of everything that's happened?
Well, you know, it's really hard to say because I've been doing it for so long. I'm comfortable with it. I know it so well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't have to go to Stack Overflow for things. I don't, you know, because I've been in it for over, you know, nearly two decades, right? So there's that comfort level I have just because I'm just comfortable with it. Mm-hmm. I know it. So it's what I've been doing for so long. But what I do love about it is the ecosystem of what, with one language, what I can build on all these different devices, not just, you know, before it was just desktop. Now you're mobile. Mm-hmm. Now you're doing cloud-based applications, SaaS applications. You're doing APIs, you know. I mean, you could do all kinds of web services and you name it. Basically, you could do it. You can extend Microsoft applications with, you know, plugins and extensions and, you know, extending Visual Studio. I mean, there's really nothing you can't do with .NET.
Mm-hmm.
And now that, you know, .NET Core is the new thing, it runs on Linux and Mac. And like, they're really, really open possibilities of, you know, what you can reach.
Yeah. Well, getting into that, you're doing a ton of stuff with the web and reaching, you know, a variety of different platforms. Kind of give us an overview. What is consuming your brain cycles these days?
Oh my gosh. Okay. So I have recently been put in charge of a product called Reveal BI. And Reveal, if you go to revealbi.io,
mm-hmm.
you'll see the product. It's an embedded data analytics SDK. Basically allows you to embed into your applications, your native applications for desktop or web or whatever, dashboards with charts and reports and all this great stuff. It's kind of like, think like Power BI, except you embed it as actual SDK that you program against.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like an iframe. You just put an app or anything like that. It's you're actually programming against it.
Okay.
And the cool thing about this product is that it targets, like, you know, WinForms, WPF, ASP.NET, Blazor, React, Angular, like web components, Android, iOS, like everything.
So how many code bases do you have to reach all those places?
We have one main code base, which is all .NET. And then we have an internal translator that translates that .NET code into these other coding languages. And so we'll write it in .NET. So for example, let's say we add a feature.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to write that feature in .NET. Then when through our release cycle, when we go to actually get it to other platforms, we run our translator, it translates the code, it goes into the other platforms, then we have our tests against it and all that stuff. And then magically it just poof, it's just there.
All right, so I hear some listeners shouting out, wait a minute, Microsoft's been telling us write in C#, and then we can target. Now you're telling me that I have to have a translator?
Yeah, because we're translating to native code. We're translating to native Swift, native Objective-C, TypeScript, right? And we don't want to have to write the code multiple times. We just want to write the code once. And of course, there are, like, we might have to make some adjustments for something that's platform specific. But for the most part, it's all translated.
Now, isn't that because you guys at Infragistics are in the unique spot where you're trying to go after Swift customers? Or would you recommend this type of thing for normal .NET shops inside of a company?
No, and I've been trying to actually convince my company to just drop Android and, you know, and iOS completely, even desktop, and just go pure web.
Okay, why is that? What's your thought process there?
Well, my thought process is the web is so versatile nowadays. It's not like it used to be. And there's so many other ways to take that web app and make it desktop compliant, to make it mobile compliant, you know, to have a mobile experience or that desktop experience that we provide now natively. There's so many ways we can do that with a web-based code base versus having to go through this whole translation process. I just think it would be easier for us to just have a web-based code base and use other strategies for getting that web code onto the other various platforms.
And what is your thought about the Blazor avenue versus, you know, going more into JavaScript or even TypeScript and pulling in Node? Because there's a lot of options out there. And how does one even sort through?
Yeah, it's a ton of options. And it's interesting because I interact with a lot of customers daily. Mm-hmm. And I see what they're doing and I see their shops. And it really depends on the shop they have. You know, if they're a .NET shop, they never worked on anything else. So one perspective of Blazor is I'm a .NET developer. I hate web. I hate JavaScript. Never want to write JavaScript. So I'm going to use Blazor and everything's going to be perfect. Well, unfortunately, when you're building real systems, even with Blazor, you're going to have to jump into JavaScript world every now and then. You're going to need something. And a lot of people may not realize, and at least the people I talk to in these, you know, these corporations and big businesses, I say you can actually use NPM packages in your Blazor app. So if there's an NPM JavaScript package you want to use, you can use it. Like, what? Yeah, you could totally do that. It's totally possible. And so I try to get people to open their minds about using JavaScript in Blazor, because I personally haven't had the greatest experience with Blazor. It's actually quite limiting in my opinion, and it has some performance issues that don't make me happy. And I just think that if you go JavaScript, you have more options available to you. So I just think it's a little easier to grasp, if you will.
Well, that'd be surprising if it wasn't the case, because the JavaScript frameworks and libraries for the web have been had a lot more years than Blazor.
Yeah.
Right. So now, in your opinion, over time, you've had the JavaScript SPA frameworks and NPM packages, and then, you know, Angular got rewritten for TypeScript. How do you sort through when you're saying, you know what, I want to use one of these libraries? How do you sort through the decision whether to use a flavor of JavaScript or TypeScript? How do you think about that?
Well, it doesn't really matter is the beautiful part about it.
But you have to pick one. You, Brian Lagunas, are going to choose which path.
I personally, anything I write in web is TypeScript.
Okay.
Anything I write. And it could just be because I've been a .NET developer for so long. I love the type checking, the strong type checking, and, you know, all the things, all the beautiful things that come with TypeScript. I can develop web apps like I do, you know, .NET apps, because of the interfaces and classes and enum, like all the types are there and it's comfortable to me. So I personally always use TypeScript.
Okay. Well, that helps, because, you know, people without your experience are thinking, I have no idea which one to pick, but it has tooling ramifications, right? Isn't there like a pretty big divide?
Yeah, the tooling, Visual Studio Code is amazing with TypeScript. You get all the IntelliSense, type checks. You basically, your JavaScript, quote unquote, JavaScript that you're writing is a lot less bug riddled. You know, TypeScript really helps you write cleaner code and less buggy code.
Now, for those integrating TypeScript into an existing .NET application, and they're in Visual Studio 2022, do they need to drop out to VS Code for anything, or can VS 2022 do everything that VS Code extensions can do?
No, Visual Studio could do whatever code can do. Code is just a lightweight editor. I've been in web so much, I haven't needed to jump into the big tools that Visual Studio gives me. And I've been able to just use what Visual Studio Code gives me, but you get the same stuff with Visual Studio.
Okay. Okay. And when you integrate ASP.NET with NPM packages, for just imagine someone who's never done it before, what does that tooling look like? Like, how do you get NPM in? What NuGet packages? What NPM? How do you kind of bridge that gap?
Yeah, you know, I actually have a YouTube video on my YouTube channel on using NPM in Blazor applications. And basically, I just walk through, you know, adding the folder where you're going to be putting all your packages, where the node modules are going to be and all that, and then creating, basically modifying your CS proj file to have little build scripts for NPM install and things like that. It's actually quite simple. So if you go to YouTube/Brian Lagunas and search for Blazor with NPM or something like that,
yeah,
you'll see exactly how it's done. It's quite simple.
Yeah, I've got it here. We'll include it in the show notes for sure. Good, good. Okay. And are there any gotchas that developers need to watch out for when using TypeScript and then using an NPM package that maybe was just regular JavaScript?
There are some. I've run into some packages that in your packages.config, for when you're using NPM packages, you have a packages.config file. You actually have to add certain assets that point to the actual node modules path to the JavaScript file for some strange reason to include it. But I think I've only really run into that to Angular application so far.
Okay.
But that might be something you have to worry about, to where when you add an NPM package, sometimes those assets don't get bundled automatically for some reason, and you have to go basically manually say, I want this JavaScript file from this node modules folder.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I want to ask you how you test your code when you've got some C# that's running on a process in a memory space on the server. And then if you're using Blazor WebAssembly, you've got some C# that's running in the browser process. Then you've got some JavaScript code that's running in the browser. You have different memory spaces going on. And even though all of your TypeScript code is actually running in the browser, probably not all of it is classified as UI code. So how do you think about the different levels of unit tests of these different types of code? And then what classifications do you create in your test libraries?
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery. Clear Measure is also happy to be a sponsor of the video podcast, Programming with Palermo. Watch, learn, and program alongside Chief Architect Jeffrey Palermo. Videos are added weekly and available on syndicated locations supporting video podcast or by visiting palermo.network. Tune in today.
So actually, if you create today, for example, an Angular application or a React application, they will actually stub out some test classes for you to start writing your tests. I don't remember. I don't use those. I don't remember what, is it Karma, maybe? I forgot what framework they use out of the box, but there's so many out there. So for us internally, we have our own testing framework that we wrote, mainly because of the translation and the multiple platforms.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition to unit tests, we'll have integration tests, and we'll also have UI tests by using something similar to Playwright, basically a UI automation tool that automates browsers.
Not Selenium either?
Playwright, have you heard of that one?
Yeah, that's the new one, but Selenium's the old one.
Yeah, Selenium's the old one. But we have an in-house one that we've built that's specific to our needs, our cross-platform needs, that does the UI testing.
Okay. Private, super secret, right?
Super secret. It's our it's our competitive advantage.
Right, I gotcha.
We've actually talked about, making our translator a public product, but we decided against it.
I'm imagining that the number of paying customers would be so low that you'd have to charge a price that basically guarantees that nobody would actually buy it.
And not many people are doing what we do anyway. We're a very specialized shop.
Right, right. You are. And for those newer developers who haven't used anything from Infragistics, I remember using controls going far as back as 2005 and six with WinForms. And I'll make a plug for you and then I'll get you to comment on it. If you're not using at least some full-fledged commercial components for something, you're missing out and you are spending way too much time creating all that code yourself. There's guaranteed to be something in your application that some other component's already doing it really, really well, and you could just drop in and get down the road.
Oh, for sure. 1,000%. Most of it you could find for free, too. Honestly.
There are tons.
In the web world, you know.
That's right. There are tons of free stuff. And, you know, Blazor is one of those things where I think Radzen and SyncFusion were one of the first ones to the game, just trying to get products out there, you know, kind of cutting edge. And there was a little blood involved with the bug. And then now everybody has Blazor controls.
Yeah. And actually, we took a different approach because we were more concerned with performance than anything else, because that's what our customers expect. Because, you know, you got banks and institutions and government institutions and like things need to be quick.
Yeah.
And especially on the web. And so we didn't write native Blazor components because those were very slow, very slow. We actually took web components and just created a wrapper around them. And so we get all the benefits of JavaScript and the speed of JavaScript without having to go through, you know, any type of framework through Blazor or anything like that, the Blazor types, anything like that.
Mm-hmm. What are the latest web projects that you've been working on that you think kind of stress the capabilities of web that really make it, you know, modern? I've heard this web 3.0 and all kinds of terms that nobody knows what they mean.
So one of our products that I'm probably most excited about and is really catching fire is called App Builder. It's basically an online WYSIWYG app designer. Now, you've probably seen things like this before. Oh, yeah, designer, drag and drop, you know, from a toolbox, and I can, you know, design my app out, make it look good and pretty. But what's cool about App Builder is not only will it, you know, allow you to design your app, but it has the concept, it's built for SPA frameworks.
Mm-hmm.
So all the routing and navigations in there, interactions, showing dialogues, clicking on buttons and having things happen, previewing those live as you develop in the browser, as you develop your app, you can share with stakeholders, right? Share a link to your design with stakeholders. And once they buy off, this is the best part, you can then generate that entire application, Blazor WASM, Blazor Server, Angular, React, web components, doesn't matter. You just hit a button and it generates your entire code base. So I'm a developer. I really suck at design and CSS. And I mean, I really struggle with layout.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I recently built an app called Excel2JSON. So it's Excel2JSON.io. And I built it because I do a lot of development where I need test data. So I'm like, oh, well, I need to build something to where I could have like an Excel spreadsheet, or, you know, I need an Excel type of experience where I can type in just rows and columns and then convert that to JSON and then expose that JSON through a REST service that I can call in my app and play with the data.
Mm-hmm.
I actually used App Builder to build that app, and it's just saved me so much. I think it only took me maybe a week to get it all done. Hmm. And that was all logic. The app part was done for me. It was amazing.
How far does that go? I mean, I can imagine it putting together a Visual Studio solution. And does it also do tests that are appropriate for that? I mean, does it do the automated builds? How far does that go?
So it doesn't do unit testing. What it does do is it allows you to, first off, you can design your app, lay it out with all the components, like, for example, a pivot grid or grid tree, whatever. Mm-hmm. You drag your grid onto the design surface. Then it lets you connect to your data. You can connect to a local host data, or you can connect to a REST service, right? You can give us your Swagger definition and we can read in all your APIs, and you can actually connect to real live data as you design it. And then when we generate the code, we generate those requests out to your API, and it has integration with GitHub. So if you publish it to GitHub, any update or changes you make in the design, it will create a pull request on GitHub so you can merge the changes into your code base. Because if you think about it this way, if you were to design the application, generate the code, now you open up that code and say Visual Studio or Visual Studio Code, whatever your IDE is, you mm-hmm. make logic changes like, oh, I click this button and I upload a file or whatever, right? Now what happens when you go and change your design again in App Builder? Well, that's where that process comes in, where it creates a pull request for you to bring in any changes into your code base on GitHub.
That's interesting, because our industry has a history of lots of different code generators that have come over time. For people who weren't around then, in the 90s, there was a huge push of case tools that went from something similar to UML to code. And of course, their long history, because they didn't pan out. But the problem is with all of these is code is generated, and then a programmer needs to modify one of the files. And exactly. then if it was to be generated again, that customization is going to be trashed or broken. So
that's the problem we solved.
What's the track record of this? Like, is it already mainstream? There are tons of people using it and it's already proven, or what would you say the status is?
This is a relatively new product, and we have customers coming on board now, because of course, when you have a new product, the best people to sell to is your existing customers.
Right.
So we've been reaching out to them, and it is catching on like wildfire with them. Like, it's really taken off in a short amount of time. We have a Discord channel for the product, and it's like the community is growing way faster than I thought it would.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah, I think the light switch technology was similar to that, except it would just regenerate files. I'm not talking about the Silverlight version, the HTML5 version.
Yeah, I remember.
People did some really fast things because it was kind of model first. So this doesn't, so you're still going to have to write your own test suites kind of when yes. you finish the design. You're still going to have to write your own build process and deploy and all that. What kind of application is it? Is it purely web applications only? Does it also do?
Right now, it's purely web application. However, we've built it in a way to where the generation model is extensible. Now, we haven't opened it up publicly yet, but we plan on opening up publicly to where people can build their own generation extensions for anything they want. So if you're a MAUI developer, right, you would just create a MAUI generator to generate and map over our object model into a MAUI application, right? Because
is that an easy thing?
I haven't personally written one yet, so I don't know.
Okay.
I can tell you that we're able to deliver, you know, Blazor WASM, Blazor Server, Angular right now, mm-hmm. and we're adding web component in just like a month or two. So if we can create one in just a month or two, I can't imagine it being super complicated, but
yeah.
I don't know. I haven't been in it, so I can't really speak to that.
And I'm guessing all the screens that are generated by App Builder probably use the full suite of InfraGistics components?
It does use all the InfraGistics components are available for use. Yes.
Oh, so when you generate, do you select if you want to use them or not? Or how does that work?
So there's a toolbox, and the toolbox has like basic components in it. You know, like, I don't know, buttons, links, you know, simple stuff. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the bigger controls like grids and tree grids and pivot grids and maps and charts and, you know, all that other stuff in there. Another thing we're looking at doing is actually opening up the toolbox in an extensible manner to where even if you don't want to use InfraGistics controls, let's say you want to use, you know, another competitor like DevExpress or SyncFusion, right? Mm-hmm. You would be able to use your components in our toolbox. So that's something else we're looking at doing.
Interesting. Now, user interfaces have always had lots of code in them because there's all kinds of behaviors that you want. And you guys and competitors you mentioned have a lot of offerings because UIs are hard. It takes a lot of labor to get them, and it's a lot of repetitive code. What about the backend processes? What are the common challenges there that need to be solved in code that's doing things that doesn't even have any screens?
So that's not really within the scope of App Builder. I mean, there are some problems we're trying to solve for the developer. One of those is like authentication, building in some type of authentication system. Another thing we're trying to solve is like a master detail scenarios where, you have multiple data sources and you select like a parent grid item or like a row. Yeah. And then you have like a child grid that you want to filter or reload more data. So there are some interesting scenarios that we are trying to see if we can automate and kind of generate for you. But for the most part, you know, we're really focused on getting that initial application built, generated out the door, ready for the developer to implement the logic.
Yeah. You know, apps, we normally think about UI when we think about apps, but there's yep. so much software that there's just data models. And I recently spoke to a person in university right now, 4-year college, and they were talking about this awesome thing that they were learning. It's like, yeah, and they call it, you know, second normal form and then third normal form databases. And it's like, wow, I've been coding since I was 12, but this stuff, man, all these problems, I'm learning how to sort my data. And I'm thinking, yeah, these are old concepts that if you don't know how to normalize or structure the data storage, your programming is going to be yeah. pretty hard.
Now, I always make a joke about that. I can always tell when a database has been developed by a developer and not a database developer, right? They look different. One is very OO, right?
Yeah.
And because it usually maps to some type of ORM or something that they use. While if a database person designed the database, it's going to be designed specifically for performance, read writes, CRUD operations, things like that.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of that, I don't know if your experience is the same, but one of the things I've seen regarding that is I've seen the long-term DBAs, they tend to map addresses when they know there's like a primary and a secondary address or a billing and a shipping address. They'll do the address one, address two type thing, whereas the OR mapper developers will create an addresses table as if we have a million addresses, or we'll yeah. need the potential for a million addresses. So whereas the DBA is like, no, you don't need that join all the time. Whereas the ORM is like, oh, but it's so easy to do it.
Yeah, it's definitely a different world. I was in databases for a while and early in my career. Yeah, it's definitely a different perspective.
Yeah. And until someone has had their performance crushed by a database that's gotten too big for the design, you just don't have the perspective to kind of push you in that direction.
Yeah. I think one of my first biggest systems was called CASE. It was cost assisted estimated system or something like that. It's been a while, but it's when I worked for a company that was responsible for building like nuclear power plants, bridges, dams, government infrastructure. Like, you know, we were a huge construction company, like 60,000 employees worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
They built big old turbines and all that. And this system would help estimate the cost to build like a nuclear power plant down to the bolt and where that bolt went. Who installs that bolt?
Mm-hmm.
How much does that person get paid to install that bolt? Like, it tracked everything. And my eyes, like, that was probably the best exposure I've had in my career, because I learned a ton about, you know, those type of applications, what's required performance wise, how things need to be architected and designed to scale and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Because not just we normally think, or we're exposed to the term big data when it's reporting databases or telemetry or eventing databases where there's tons of generated data. But the transactional store that you're talking about, just in its very nature, is massive.
Oh yeah. And keep in mind, you know, when you're not only do you have to track all the stuff and estimate the cost, but now you have to take into account, you know, the currency, what time of year it is, what's the exchange rate, when's the estimated completion date, what's the calculation for the cost through the, you know, the rise and fall of the dollar. And it was an insane system. It was a really fun system to work on.
Yeah, everybody needs a really good kick in the butt experience to grab them.
I have not seen a system like that since, though. Now all the systems I work on or have in the past have been comparatively quite simple.
But like you said, you get to talk with tons of customers who are doing everything under the sun.
I talk to stock traders a lot in the financial industry. Man, they got some interesting setups. You know, those guys with like 12 monitors with all these charts everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are fun apps to be involved with as well.
Yeah, you want to get video card recommendations from them. So I'm putting together a computer, and I need 4K on 12 monitors. What'd you use? So anyway, well, hey, as we get to the end of our time here, for those developers who are kind of wanting to move more into the modern web space, if you know they want to dig in, they just don't know what the next steps are, you know, where would you steer them?
I would steer them to a project they want. You know, the best way to learn is to write and just struggle through it. Find a project that you, even if it's like a to-do app, it doesn't have to be anything big and fancy or public. Just find a project you're interested in writing and start writing it. And the technology, if you're new and you're thinking, oh, what technology should I learn? Should I learn Blazor or Angular or React, or I'm new to this and I want to get into the job market? My advice is look in your area, who's hiring and what are they hiring for? Mm. That's where I would start. If you look at your market and everyone's hiring for React, you need to learn React because you want to get a job in your area, don't want to move, learn React. If they're hiring for Angular, learn Angular first, right? So that would be my advice. Who's paying? That's what you learn.
That's good advice. That's good advice. All right. Well, hey, I appreciate you coming on the Azure DevOps podcast and sharing us your take and experience on modern web. And it's great to have you on the show, Brian.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I have to come back and then we can actually talk about how we release all that software.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Awesome. Thanks so much. And until next time, keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps Podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.